In the last few episodes, we have been rushing through the rich history of events in the 13th century in Cologne. Logically, we have hardly had any time for long-term developments here. Time to finally catch up. For this episode, I would like to take another look at Cologne's Jewish population, as far as research and literature allows. The Jews were the only major non-Christian group in Western Europe, a place that was nearly entirely Christian at that time. The focus will be more this episode on their legal status rather than the quarter where they lived itself. For that, we already have an entire episode dedicated to that topic. Here we want to learn how Christians and Jews managed to live everyday life in the 13th century. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old. But until it became what it is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a kind of microcosm of European history. And in this podcast, you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. So let's jump right into the topic right after the intro. The high medieval boom, which was noticeable in Cologne economically and above all in the increasing number of inhabitants, logically did not stop at Cologne's Jewish population. In the second half of the 13th century in particular, there was a strong influx of new Jewish inhabitants to Cologne. We often even know where they came from, as they recorded this in the corresponding shrine books, the medieval land registers in Cologne. Many Jewish families came from Andernach, Duisburg, Koblenz, Frankfurt, and Mainz, but also from England, Westphalia, and even Belgium and today's Netherlands. But what drew them to Cologne? Was it economic opportunities or perhaps the protection guaranteed by the archbishop in office? It's hard to say. One thing is certain. The Jewish community flourished and grew steadily. Around 500 to 600 Jews lived in Cologne in the 13th century. The Jewish quarter itself had around 50 to 60 houses, compared to a population of nearly 40,000 Cologne inhabitants in total. As you know, medieval Cologne was divided and organized into so-called wards, like city districts, which usually ran along the corresponding district boundaries of the parishes. Although the Jewish quarter in the heart of the city was geographically located in the ward of the parish church of St. Lawrence, it was still considered its own ward in its own right. And the Jewish community was just as well organized as a ward. The synagogue was not only a place of prayer, but also the center of social and legal life. Oaths were taken here, community disputes were settled, and rabbinical judgments were handed down. Another important building was the so-called Bridal Dance and Games House, which was built in 1258 at the latest. This was not only a banqueting hall, but also a symbol of the flourishing Jewish community that liked to party and have fun. Then there was the Women's Synagogue, which existed in 1200 at the latest, and the mikvah, the ritual bath, which was probably built in this form as we know it, as early as the 12th century. Jewish autonomy, jurisdiction, and administration. Jews had far-reaching autonomy here in their quarter. They were organized as a cooperative, similar to Christian brotherhoods, and elected their own community leader, the so-called Jew bishop. From today's perspective, the word bishop is misleading, though. It was a purely secular office and had nothing religious about it. However, as bishops were often the highest political representatives at the time, the term was probably chosen for that position. This Jew bishop was supported by a 12-member council guiding him. If you want to delve a little deeper into the organizational structure of the Jewish quarter, I would like to refer to you episode 57 regarding the organizational structure and appearance of the quarter. The Jewish cemetery in front of the Severin Gate in the south of medieval Cologne was a particularly impressive sign of the Jewish community's growth. It had already been extended in 1174 because not only Cologne Jews, but also Jews from neighboring towns were buried there. Why am I mentioning this? The cemetery, it will become important again in a moment. In the Middle Ages, everyone was a subject of someone. Even a duke de jure served his emperor or king, so whose subjects were the members of Cologne's Jewish community? In the case of Cologne, we know that the original royal right to be patron of all Jews in the empire was transferred to the Archbishop of Cologne as fief. This protection by the Archbishop, as you have heard several times here in the podcast, was a double-edged sword. As a small minority, you had a powerful ally, one of the most powerful men in the empire, the Archbishop of Cologne, but this protection was sometimes good, sometimes not so good. Especially when the Archbishop was not in Cologne or simply unwilling to enforce the protection he had promised. And above all, this so-called protection cost money. A lot of money. Especially for the Jews in the city of Cologne, we can see that the protection was rather suboptimal. While he himself took over the protection of the Jews, I mean the Archbishop, in all secular possessions in his domain, he had already handed this, in the city of Cologne, over to the citizens of Cologne in the 13th century. However, the Archbishop did not involve the citizens financially in any way. The Archbishop, therefore, regularly collected protection money for the Jews of Cologne, but the citizens of Cologne, who were familiar with this on the city's territory, saw none of the money. A point of contention that was also raised by both sides in the small and large arbitration a few episodes earlier. Of course, this was not an advantage for the Jews in Cologne. As a bone of contention between the Archbishop and the citizens of Cologne, it harbored the danger of being caught between the two parties in event of conflict. As I said in the intro, I will focus more on the legal status, but I would also like to take a short look at art, Christian art, and how they depicted the Jews in the 13th century, and how we can make assumptions about how everyday life was in the city or in general in Europe. Christian art from the 13th century in the cathedral of today's Cologne Cathedral shows how Christians and Jews interacted. I mean, it's not a whole full picture, but it's something. Of course, this short excursion, as I said, cannot give us a complete picture, but at least an insight. We have already talked about how Cologne Cathedral was built in the Middle Ages. They didn't build the shell of the building first, they built it in sections, and even the sections were built in sections. As a result, the first windows of Cologne Cathedral were installed in the choir as early as 1260, 12 years after the foundation stone of the new Gothic cathedral was laid. The so-called older Bible window, as there is also a younger Bible window, was installed exactly in 1260. You can still see it today in the choir of the Axis Chapel of Cologne Cathedral, because in World War II, they were able to save that window before the bombs started falling. If that doesn't tell you anything, this window, just come along an imaginary walk with me through Cologne Cathedral. Just go all the way back to the cathedral and then stand in a circle around the shrine of the three wise men right in the center and look at the middle window. There's a red stripe on the left and a green stripe on the right in that window. Scenes from the Old Testament are depicted on the left, and where the red line is running through, while scenes from the New Testament are directly opposite on the right with that green strip plane or whatever. So you notice, if you look up and down the window, that always an Old Testament scene is put next to a New Testament scene, so that there is this theological connection that the Old Testament leads to the New Testament, the cornerstone of the Christian faith. One Old Testament scene shows the weaning of Isaac. All those involved are wearing so-called Jewish hats. These are wide-brimmed hats with a pointed tip. In Christian art of the Middle Ages, this was a stylistic device to depict figures, so people of Jewish faith, as such. In this scene, it's simply just that, to show the viewer that this is an Old Testament scene about Jews. And for that segment, just for this scene, there's no devaluation in this excerpt. Of course, I will put a picture of the older Bible window on my homepage, thehistoryofcologne.com. But we find another artistic representation with Jewish hats when we turn around on the spot in the cathedral after looking at the older Bible window in the access chapel. Above us, and well protected, we see the shrine of the three wise men. Incidentally, funnily enough, this was not there in the Middle Ages, but exactly where the window we have just discussed was located in the access chapel, there the shrine used to be. At the front of the shrine, we find Jews such as Moses or King Solomon. They are not wearing Jewish hats, but are clearly recognizable as such. Moses carries the Tanakh in his hands, and Solomon is depicted as a Jewish king. Here too, the Jewish men mentioned are not portrayed in a bad light, rather as pioneers of Christianity, no New Testament without the Old Testament. But if you go to the back of the same shrine, you see a completely different depiction of the Jews. Here we see the story of the Passion of Jesus, meaning that alongside a traditional crucifixion scene, we see a particularly provocative depiction of the scourging of Jesus. Instead of the Roman soldiers, as mentioned in the Bible, there are now two men beating Jesus with rods, identified as Jews by their hats. An important clue to the meaning of this scene can be found in the inscription at the top, where it says, "The true victim Jesus was spat upon and beaten with blows." End quote. This text refers not only to the scourging by Roman soldiers, but also to an episode in the Gospel of Mark in which servants of the Jewish High Council beat and spit on Jesus, Mark 14:65. And the interesting thing is that the faces of those Jews beating Jesus in the Passion scene, those faces are hardly human anymore. They rather look like demons from hell. Such depictions became increasingly common from the 12th century onwards in the wake of anti-Judaism and reinforced the late antiquity idea that Jews were actively involved in Jesus' death. As already mentioned, this view was already widespread in early Christian texts that blamed the Jews for Jesus' death. In the 12th and 13th centuries, Jews were increasingly seen not just as a religious community with individual humans, but as a group, all lumped together and held collectively responsible that they had one single will and not being a heterogeneous group at all. It is particularly problematic that the Jews of the time were equated with those from the biblical tradition. This is how the Jews who beat Jesus are depicted in the contemporary fashion or art of the 13th century. The Jews you see on the shrine of the three wise men are depicted how Jews used to look like, according to clothes, not their faces, because at that time they were already forced to wear those Jewish hats to be recognizable as Jews. As you noticed, I find it difficult to summarize this correctly, but it shows how complex the relationship was. Without Judaism on one side, Christianity would never have come into being. At the same time, however, the Jews, quotation marks, all lumped together, as I said, at that time, were blamed for killing the Christian Messiah. This would lead to further marginalization in the 13th century, and we will discuss what these were and how they materialized later. What we now had was glass and painted art in a window and a shrine. A reliquary in which we saw contemporary depictions of Jews in the 13th century. All these objects were made in the 13th century. But I would like to talk about another object, and yes, there are many, many more examples in the cathedral, which above all, without any abstract biblical exegesis, gives a brief but clear insight into the relationship in everyday life of Cologne's Jews and Christians. Carved in stone, this object has stood in Cologne Cathedral for almost 800 years and is in excellent condition, around 2 meters high. Nevertheless, many people walk past this stone steel regardless. Even great cathedral connoisseurs often disregard this important historical testimony as they pass by, the so-called Cologne Jewish Privilege from 1266. What was this so-called Jewish privilege of 1266? In purely physical terms, it is a large man-sized stone slab in Cologne Cathedral, erected by Archbishop Engelbert II von Falkenburg in 1266. The stone slab itself was engraved with a Latin text. A special thing about it is that although it looks like a stone slab, it is actually a medieval document. The content is also structured like a medieval document. We'll come to that in a moment. The only difference is that this is not written in ink on parchment, but carved in stone. Still, it looks like a document. This is not entirely unusual, as 70 medieval documentary texts carved in stone have survived in the city of Cologne. So they existed, yes, but just rarely. In contrast, nowadays we have 25,000 documents from Cologne that have survived to this day, which were written on parchment or paper in the High Middle Ages and early modern period. So 17 in stone versus 25,000 on parchment. That's quite a number. It was probably important to the Archbishop that the document was recorded in stone. Why else the great effort? This also emphasized, by the way, it was set up. If you have the opportunity, take a close look at the stone slab in the cathedral. It is in immaculate conditions. It has stood protected from the wind and weather in Cologne Cathedral for around 760 years. It has been in various locations in the cathedral, but was never put outside. Why was that stone slab placed in the cathedral? Wouldn't it have made more sense to put it somewhere outside where more people would see it? One thing is certain. Of course, if the stone slab had been, for example, in the Jewish quarter, it would certainly have been destroyed during the later pogrom in the 14th century. To cut a long story short, it was not uncommon to place such inscriptions in stone, even those that were not religious, but as in our case contained secular matters, in churches. It was totally normal. Church interiors are consecrated spaces. Damaging the contents inside of a church is a direct offense against God and secures you a ticket straight to hell. It was in the interest of the Archbishop as well as the Jewish community itself to emphasize with the cathedral location that the provisions on the stone slab were legally valid and specially protected. Why were documents actually drawn up in that time? The motives are the same as today. You want to record things as securely and visibly as possible, such as rights and obligations. Nowadays, as in the past, something like party A sells his property to party B on the following terms, etc., etc. You put all of that in a document. The Jewish privilege of 1266 was not the first kind of that in Cologne. Konrad von Hochstaden, for example, pretty much known to us now in the podcast, had already drawn up a similar document in 1252. 10 more archiepiscopal letters of protection were to be issued like that up to 1372. What is special about the letter of protection here from 1266 was its stone form. However, it should not be ruled out that there were also parchment versions of that. Unfortunately, if they existed, they have not survived. As you know, I'm a fan of letting historical texts speak for themselves. Let's do that, and we'll analyze it afterwards. You don't have to understand everything straight away, of course. We'll go into individual points covered afterwards. We will, of course, read the text in English and not in Latin for the salvation for us all. The document has a classic structure that a document has. Usually it has three parts: protocol, context, and eschatology. I have no idea how to pronounce it in English, the last word. Roughly speaking, it means you have an introduction, a main part, and a final part. These three parts break down roughly as follows. In the intitulatio, we learn who the issuer of this document is. In our case, the Archbishop of Cologne. This is followed by the promulgatio, so the typical proclamation formula notum sit, which is Latin for it is known that, and then it goes on and on like that. Because this is then followed by the narratio, which leads us into the main section of the document. The narratio shows the derivation, or rather shows the background that led to the creation of the document. Here, the archbishop felt that the Jews in Cologne, who were under his protection after all, were being treated unfairly by the city. And the dispositio then goes into the nitty-gritty. Engelbert II announces the legal steps he will now take as a result. It is rounded off at the end with the corroboratio, the authentication of the document, and ends with the dating. Sorry for the generic talk, but my studies at university must have been good for something, so I wanted to tell you all of that. But now, let's really get into the text. It says, quote, "We, Engelbert, by the grace of God, Archbishop of the Holy Roman Church of Cologne, make known to all forever that we have realized that the Jews of the Diocese of Cologne have fallen into an unjust situation and have suffered various injustices. Therefore, with the consent of the Cathedral Chapter and our priors, and on the advice of our faithful, we have restored them to their ancient liberties, which are contained below. The liberties of the Jews are therefore as follows. First, that the burials of Jews, regardless of the manner of death by which they died and from whence they are brought, shall take place without the levying of any customs or other duties for burial or demands extorted in any way. They shall be buried freely in their cemetery outside the walls of Cologne, regardless of what they may have done in life. Exclude are the burials of Jews who died under the judgment of excommunication of the Jews or who were executed by a lawful sentence of blood. No official of the Archbishop of Cologne or any judge shall execute any blood judgment in the said cemetery, be it on the bodies of Christians or Jews. Nor shall this be done in a place so close that the Jews suffer shame as a result. Second, likewise, the Jews, whoever they may be and wherever they may come from, shall pay the same customs, duties, and tolls for themselves and their goods in the territories of the Archbishop of Cologne as the Christians, and shall not be obliged to pay anything else. And third, nor should any Christians who lend openly for interest and thereby cause damage be allowed to live in the city of Cologne. And since these Jews are rightly to be preserved in such liberties, we have had the same liberties engraved on this stone for perpetual remembrance in a public place for everyone's inspection, given in the year of our Lord 1266." End quote. So you see, the Archbishop felt compelled to reaffirm the rights already granted to the Jews of Cologne, as in his eyes, they were no longer really respected by the citizens of Cologne. He speaks clearly of an unfortunate situation that the Jews had got into in the meantime. The text of the stone slab does not reveal exactly what this means for the year 1266, though, what really happened. The confirmed rights which the Archbishop wishes to reaffirm are as follows: the free and undisturbed burial of the dead in their own cemetery south of the city wall, equal rights to pay customs, duties and taxes in the Archbishop's territory as well as Christians do, and a monopoly on credit transactions. Of course, if you think about it, that all sounds nice at first. Thank you, dear Archbishop, for protecting the Jewish community like that. But the Archbishop did not do this out of Christian charity. There were very radical, pragmatic considerations at work here. The Jews in Cologne and in his domain were directly subordinate to him as fiefdoms. He could tax them as he wished, and, as with so many other things, did not have to be persuaded by counts, dukes, city councillors, or anyone else in doing so. Securing this lucrative source of income was the top priority for him, the Archbishop. Guaranteeing them, the Jews, a monopoly on money lending was not entirely altruistic as well. After all, he himself was someone who liked to borrow huge amounts of money from the Jewish lenders in Cologne, convenient when these were his own legally dependent subjects. However, the fact that the Archbishop had to stand up for his Jews, here also shows that there were probably occasional disputes in everyday life between Christians and Jewish Cologne residents. After all, he would not have to make this document. I have already said it. Neither a single church window from that time, nor the shrine of the Holy Three Kings, let alone a 2-meter-high stone slab, can give us a complete picture of the relationship between Jews and Christians in the city at the time, but they do give us an insight into everyday life. An everyday life that was characterized by rules that had to be rebalanced or reaffirmed from time to time, as it seems. Times of comparatively good coexistence were joined by times of dispute and hostility. So living together can be summarized in such a way. It was, I know that historians love to say, more complex than one often thinks. As I said, the content of the text in this Jewish privilege is not really anything special. It joins the list of a total of 11 archbishops' letters of protection for Jews that were written between 1252 and 1372. What makes it special here is that it is made of stone and was deliberately displayed in public in Cologne Cathedral, which was still under construction at that time for many, many centuries. In 1266, the new building had only been under construction for 18 years. Only the sacristy and some lower levels of the choir would have been completed by then. As the content of the Jewish privilege of 1266 can be included in a long series of similar documents, we should perhaps take another look at the general relationship between the Jews of Cologne and their patron or their largely Christian environment. In the 13th century, the Archbishop of Cologne now ruled over a considerable area along the Rhine and far beyond, for example, in the Duchy of Westphalia. This makes him one of the most powerful rulers of the Holy Roman Empire and one of the only 7 exclusive electors who alone are allowed to elect the Roman German king. Until the plague of 1348, his dominion, including Cologne, was a place of flourishing Jewish life. It can be assumed that around 2,000 to 3,000 Jews lived in the secular domain of the Archbishop of Cologne along the Rhine and in Westphalia. Of these, 500 to 600 lived in Cologne alone. From today's perspective, this number of 2,000 to 3,000 would be an extremely small number for our ears, knowing that there are cities that have 1 million inhabitants or more. However, at that time, a number of 2,000 to 3,000 people was a small city already, a middle-sized city already. Cologne was regarded as the capital of Rhenish and Westphalian Judaism, where scholars came together and exchanged ideas, such as Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, who became an important Talmudic scholar of his time in the 13th century. Although the Jews were regarded as social outcasts in the otherwise largely Christian empire, unlike heretics, pagans, or unbelievers, their religion was tolerated and not subject to constant opposition. Christianity had emerged from the Old Testament, and the God of the Christians himself was a born Jew. Only this circumstance made it possible for there to be longer phases of comparatively good and peaceful coexistence. But, of course, I do not neglect that. It is true that in the 13th century, coexistence darkened noticeably. While Jews had been important long-distance traders, even especially in the early and high Middle Ages, after all the Jews in the diaspora had communities everywhere in the then-known world that they could access locally, this changed when Christian long-distance traders began to compete with them. The Crusades, for example, in particular, ensured that the Christians themselves now took over local trade to the Middle East. The step-by-step exclusion from trade and commerce, as one had to be a member of a Christian guild for that, finally pushed the Jews into an outsider role. So if you did not have a job in the quarter itself for supplying your own folk, like being a butcher, a baker, or something like that, all that remained was the frowned upon a job as a lender, as a money lender. As we learn from the Jewish privilege of 1266 that only Jews and not Christians were allowed to be moneylenders in Cologne, this fueled the anti-Jewish sentiment that they, the Jews, were greedy and a cutthroat. Considering that for many Jews, unless you were, like I said, the baker or butcher for the Jewish neighborhood, this was an unfair accusation. I mean, what else should they work for if they were not allowed to be a farmer, a trader, or a craftsman? Especially if, as was the case at the beginning of the 14th century, you were taxed more and more heavily and by several authorities in the city. At that time, not only the archbishop wanted money for his protection, the city council of Cologne as well wanted to get their share. And I mean, it's almost a miracle how the Jewish community managed to bear these high costs without going bankrupt. In addition, the climate worsened in the empire and in Europe. The warm peak of the High Middle Ages slowly came to an end that had led to prosperity growth and a population growth after all. It became now colder and the harvests were poorer. This set another spiral in motion out of fear and ignorance and hate, of course. The Jews were blamed for this, which led to further accusations that they would carry out obscure blood rituals and commit murders for that. Which is also absolutely nonsense because the Jewish faith clearly forbids the use of blood, something that strictly observant Jews pay particular attention to when preparing food, even nowadays, keyword kosher food. It was said that Jews would commit ritual murders of Christian children for all of this. In times when not every illness or medical issue could be explained, this rumor, this idea of it, held great potential for conflict. Child mortality was high until the advent of modern medicine. If a child died of a disease that was unknown to the people of the time, suspicion quickly fell on the Jews in their own town that they might have had something to do with it, which is, of course, nonsense. So you see, Jews in Cologne, but also in Europe in general, did indeed need protection. It is therefore all the more tragic that those who were supposed to provide protection did not take it quite so seriously. The original duty of the king slash emperor, or now the Archbishop of Cologne in our case, to protect the Jews increasingly became a right of the patron which could be utilized and exploited. Originally, free people became dependent subjects. If protection was granted by the Archbishop, it was to protect his lenders and avert economic damage to him, the Archbishop himself. Without their financial power, the Archbishops of Cologne would never have become the powerful rulers of the empire that we know from the history books. But sadly, that's where the protection stopped, and sometimes it even stopped way earlier than that. Let us therefore slowly come to an end for this episode. The Jewish privilege of 1266 is similar in content to other documents from that era. What makes it special, however, is its form in stone and its location inside of Cologne Cathedral. It does not give us a comprehensive, but at least a good insight into the relationship between the Jews, the Archbishop, and the Christian majority in the city. In this respect, however, the Jewish privilege of 1266 stands out in that the text is neither anti-Jewish or pro-Jewish. It's simply what a document usually is, a sober, administrative, legal text. What did I use as literature this time? Above all, the book Der Kölner Dom und die Juden, so Cologne Cathedral and the Jews, which was published in 2008 as a special volume of the Kölner Domblatt, the magazine of the Port Club of Cologne Cathedral, the Cologne Cathedral Building Association. They published a book like that with several articles. Joachim Oepen's chapter on the Jewish privilege of 1266 in particular was the basis for this episode. As you are listening to the podcast, Joachim, best wishes to you if you're listening to the English version of the podcast. I have no idea. Furthermore, of course, Hugo Stehkämper and Karl Dietmar's City History Volume, Köln im Hochmittelalter, so Cologne in the High Middle Ages, served me as well, and Das Jüdische Köln, so Jewish Cologne by Barbara Becker-Jackli. Many thanks to Martin, Karen, Silvia, Christian, Antje, Tabo, Sabine, Angela, Ingo, another Sabine, and another Sabine for your tips via PayPal. Next time, we'll be looking at different aspects of 13th century Cologne society as well. Well, what really exactly? I will surprise you. So, thank you for listening. Rate this podcast wherever you listen to, and auf Wiedersehen.